Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Sheckman. One of the things we've been hearing lately with respect to our own domestic politics is the debate between conscience and politics. Sometimes our desire to see our own side win has to be tempered by a broader view of the moral and human dimensions of an issue. The ongoing struggle in the Middle East between Israel and the Palestinian people is no different. No matter the depth of our appreciation of the remarkable miracle that is Israel, the matter of the Palestinians and some of the decisions and actions taken by Israel must be viewed in the larger moral context. In order to do that, we have to really understand what's happening on the ground, in the West Bank, in Gaza, and in Israel. My guest, Ben Ehrenreich, has been there. He has gone there to live among the people and learn firsthand the enormity of what's going on. His writing has appeared in Harper's, the New York Times Magazine, and the London Review of Books. He's a recipient of the National Magazine Award, and it is my pleasure to welcome Ben Ehrenreich to Radio Who, What, Why.
Thank you, Jeff. It's a great pleasure to be here.
One of the things that you talk about is really a sense of being surprised, shocked about what you saw on the ground taking place in Palestine. Talk a little bit about that first.
Sure. And I think the surprise goes even farther back to the first time that I went to work as a journalist in the West Bank, which was in the spring of 2011. And I think I knew as much as I could when I got there. You know, I'd read everything I could possibly read. I'd prepared myself as well as I could. And I thought I had a pretty good grasp on what the situation was. And was first really viscerally shocked and disturbed by what I saw in terms of just the absolute transformation of the landscape. I'd been there about a decade earlier and really couldn't believe how much things had changed in terms of really the brutalization of the actual land itself. The wall we all know about, which in some places is 8 meters high of concrete, the checkpoints everywhere, the settlements, some places it feels like every hilltop there's an Israeli settlement, you know, which all have their own fences and barbed wire around them and usually have an Israeli military base on a settlement right next to that. All of that was more than I was really prepared for. And then I think the other thing that really shocked me on that trip was just the pace of events, that everywhere you looked, there were things happening, not good things, you know, but everywhere I went, and sometimes I sought these things out, and sometimes, more often than not, I would just go somewhere and things would happen. And I'm talking about land confiscations, you know, settlers taking over Palestinian land. I'm talking about peaceful demonstrations by Palestinians being put down with overwhelming force by the Israeli military, arrests, beatings, et cetera, et cetera. Sort of everywhere I went, there was kind of something awful happening. And I wasn't quite ready for all that because most of that doesn't make it into the news here. Most of these very daily realities of life in the West Bank are simply not reported on in the U.S. And that made it all the more urgent for me to try to get those stories out.
The overwhelming sense of it is that obviously each time you had gone back and as you report on it over time, that the situation continues to deteriorate, that it's one of those situations which is unusual, that it's not like it gets better and then it gets worse, it gets better. This just continues to get worse in so many respects.
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, I think there are there are ups and downs. There are periods where it seems like nothing is happening, which will last for a while. And you know, when you stay there longer, you start to get more of a sense of the rhythms of things. There'll be times where everybody seems depressed, and then there are brief moments of momentum when people are suddenly hopeful about one thing or another, and then those dissipate, and it goes back to falls back into a sort of quiet depression as things get worse.
Talk a little bit about the difference between the situation on the West Bank and in Gaza.
I mean, they're quite different, and I can't speak that knowledgeably about Gaza because I've only been there once, and it was quite briefly. I was there before the last war in the spring of 2014. Gaza is, it is no exaggeration to say that it is an open prison. It is walled off on every side but the sea. To go through, to go in or out means going through very intense, crossings, which most people are not able to pass through at all. The amount of goods that are allowed in is severely restricted by the Israeli government. When I was there, there was just a huge crisis. There was very little, particularly fuel coming in. People's horizons are enormously, enormously limited. It's hard to exaggerate how much they're limited by. And of course, things have gotten significantly worse there since the war that summer of 2014, in which more than 2,000 people were killed and huge amounts of not only buildings but really basic infrastructure were destroyed. In the West Bank, there's a wall, of course, between the West Bank and Israel. And it's, I would say, a larger and more open kind of prison. It's still the case that people's horizons are severely limited. People's ability to move freely, not only between the West Bank and Israel, but often within the West Bank, is curtailed by Israeli security forces and by checkpoints. The level of insecurity in people's daily lives is also, quite extreme. People try as hard as they can, like people do anywhere, to live normally, but they also know that, everything can kind of vanish in an instant, as, lives can be taken at checkpoints. People can be arrested for no reason and without charge. Their land can be taken, their homes can be demolished. So people are constantly living with a powerful amount of insecurity.
Given that the situation has gone on for so long, talk a little bit about generational attitudes, because we're in a world now there where almost three generations have experienced precisely what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think there's a real profound difference between the generation of people who are a little older than me. I'm in my mid-40s, and the youth now. I mean, the people who are closer to my generation lived through the first Intifada, which for Palestinians was a profoundly unifying uprising. It was a largely unarmed uprising. It happened for the most part independent of the PLO. The PLO was at the time in exile in Tunisia, and it was this really sort of grassroots movement, village to village, of people trying to, push off the occupation and do for themselves what the occupation was refusing to do for them. It was, so people experienced it with sort of these great revolutionary hopes, which were subsequently dashed. And that generation, I think, there's a great deal of disillusion because they grew up through this revolutionary experience, and those hopes were ultimately, let down. And the youth who have grown up, since the Oslo Agreement, since 1993, 1994, put in place the Palestinian Authority and kind of institutionalized a Palestinian leadership which has actually very little authority. What Oslo did was it created this sort of the semblance of a state while leaving Israel in control of most aspects of Palestinian life. And there's a huge amount of disillusion with the PA and with the leadership of the older generation of the youth. And I think, that's behind a lot of what we saw in the last 6 months or so, where there was this, some people call it an uprising or intifada, but this outbreak of attacks on Israelis, mainly by very young people, by teenagers, mainly in an uncoordinated fashion, using, household implements, using kitchen knives, screwdrivers, scissors, people attacking Israeli soldiers and police and sometimes civilians, and usually being killed in the process. And that, I think, was a symptom of the deep despair that's felt by young Palestinians, and their alienation from the traditional leadership, as well as from, you know, certainly from Israeli society.
Has the despair given way to anger, or anger given way to despair?
Oh, I think they're pretty well connected. It's hard to separate them out.
Talk a little bit about the anger and what you hear among the people that you lived with, that you spent so much time with on the West Bank.
You know, there's certainly plenty of anger. I think, given what people live with, it's surprising how little anger there is. Mm-hmm. That people still live with a great deal of humor and warmth. And most Palestinians, in my experience, were able to separate out, you know, I'm an American, you know, I have an American passport, I enjoy all the privileges of being a citizen of a country that gives $3.1 billion a year to the Israeli military. And, you know, to that degree, people would be perfectly justified in mistrusting and disliking me. And for the most part, they didn't. You know, for the most part, people understood that there's a difference between individuals and their governments, and even in their relationships with Israelis. For the most part, there's not many Israelis who come into the West Bank, into Palestinian areas, but those who do, and in particular in villages like Nabi Saleh, where I spent a lot of time, where there's a protest movement which really relies on the solidarity of Israelis, I think most Palestinians would welcome Israelis who came to them with open minds and open hearts, and who were willing to try to understand the situation from their perspectives.
What is the sense of understanding among the Palestinians with respect to the attitudes towards the Israeli people versus the Israeli government?
You know, it varies. I mean, some people are deeply enraged, and you know, at the moment, unfortunately, the Israeli society has moved quite far to the right. The elected leadership in Israel is extremely aggressively right wing, and for the most part, they've been elected by the Israeli people, and so there is an understanding among Palestinians that there's a lot of people on the other side of that wall that really don't like them.
Talk a little bit about your own personal experiences, some of the families that you came in contact with, and some of the resiliency that you experienced really so personally.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that that made me want to keep going back there and eventually made me decide to move there was that for all of the darkness and all of the violence, and by which I mean, you know, both immediate forms of violence that involve, you know, gunshots and whatnot, and the kind of quieter forms of institutional violence that really tear away at the fabric of people's lives. You know, despite all of that, there's a warmth and a humor to people, which was, enormously welcoming and appealing. I spent a lot of time in places living in a way that most Americans would recognize as, you know, extremely normal, like hanging out with families and their kids while their kids play video games and watch TV and do the things that people do everywhere. And one of the things that led me to really want to write this book was that is something we never or almost never see in the American media, as any understanding of not only what the realities of the occupation mean for Palestinians, but the fact that Palestinians are, you know, human beings like we are, with the same kind of longings for dignity, who want the same things out of life that we want. In the U.S. press, for the most part, we hear about Palestinians as terrorists or as victims, and not as some thing that we can relate to, as people with any relevance or kinship to our own lives.
How much of that attitude that you see in the rest of the world, viewing Palestinians in that way, how much of it makes its way back to the Palestinian people? How much of that do they sense and understand?
It depends. I think most Palestinians have a pretty good sense of how they're portrayed in the media, and are certainly not pleased, and understand that particularly in the U.S., because I think the U.S. media is far more univocal about this than the media in Europe or anywhere else in the world. But that the Palestinians are largely portrayed as terrorists, as aggressors, and that their humanity is not accounted for, really, in the least, for the most part.
And is there a sense of wanting to do something to change that image?
Yeah, but I think for the most, you know, I mean, if you were portrayed as something other than human by everyone around you, no one wants to have to prove their humanity, you know. One wants it to be respected, and it's a kind of a further indignity to be asked to prove it. But that said, you know, certainly in places like Nabi Saleh, this village where I spent a lot of time, a lot of the way they structured their resistance, it's a village where they march against the, they try to march to a spring, which was taken by the settlers who live across the valley from them, and are every week, you know, met with kind of overwhelming firepower by the Israeli military. But part of their approach is definitely geared towards the rest of the world, and, you know, having foreigners, foreign solidarity activists and Israeli solidarity activists there, is very much a part of their, of how they understand their strategy, that they're trying to resurrect a different understanding of what, you know, Palestinian resistance might mean, for the rest of the world.
And what's happening on the grassroots level, particularly among younger Palestinians?
At the moment, not a lot. At the moment, not a lot. I think the defeats have been profound, particularly the events that have occurred while I was there and in the summer of 2014. You know, the war in Gaza, which took more than 2,000 lives. I think people are feeling quite defeated for the most part, and there's not a whole lot of dynamism on the ground among the young. There's also a great deal of disillusion with their own leadership, and an understanding that what the Palestinian Authority mainly does, and this is very different from our how it's reported on here, but I think it's accurate, that what the PA mainly does is actually tries to stop any real resistance to the Israeli occupation. So they very much see their own leadership as a sort of puppet controlled by Israel.
And talk a little bit about why the Palestinian Authority takes that attitude. What do they hope to gain by that?
You know, to preserve their own power. But I think it's largely structural. I mean, I think, you know, there are individual motivations, and there, you know, the Oslo and the creation of the PA did create an elite within Palestinian society, which has its own privileges, which are, you know, both in terms of power and money, and those are strong motivations for the people who have power and money. But I think it's structural. I mean, Oslo, I think, created this sort of this class of people within Palestinian society whose privileges are very much tied to the status quo and are very much tied to not challenging Israel. So I think it's, you know, there were Edward Said, the great Palestinian scholar, the moment the Oslo Declaration was issued, the Oslo Treaty was signed, he understood the situation quite well, that this wasn't peace, this was a continuation of the occupation through various veils. And a lot of other people have been slower in understanding that, but I think it's become quite clear.
Who, if anyone, do the Palestinians trust?
Well, it depends which Palestinians. You know, I mean, there are nearly 2 million Palestinians in the West Bank, 1.8 million Palestinians in Gaza, and, you know, it's one can't generalize with numbers that big. But, you know, for the most part, Israel has been pretty good at getting rid of viable Palestinian leaders. You know, one leader who's maintained a great deal of legitimacy and popularity in among Palestinians in the West Bank is Marwan Barghouti, who is, you know, in prison and will be for likely for the rest of his life. So viable leaders rarely last very long.
I mean, there is this sense of, and maybe it's fantasy and maybe it's just wanting history to repeat itself, but this desire to see a kind of Palestinian Mandela emerge from all of this.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there are those desires, but at the same time, when those leaders emerge, they tend to be very quickly imprisoned. So, you know, on the one hand, there are often calls for a Palestinian, you know, nonviolent movement led by somebody like, you know, where is the Palestinian Mandela? Where is the Palestinian Martin Luther King? But at the same time, the Israeli government does a very good job at getting rid of and imprisoning those people and using violence to crush any nonviolent resistance movement that that threatens to come forth.
What did you come to see as the potential role of the U.S. in all of this?
Well, I mean, I think the U.S. has historically played a quite, looking for the right word, the role the U.S. has played is not a viable one. You know, on the one hand, the U.S. Supports Israel with, again, $3.1 billion a year in military aid, more than we give to anyone else in the world, and at the same time blocks all criticism of Israel in international bodies like the UN, absolutely unwavering supporter of Israel, and only criticizes it in the most qualified terms. So, at the one hand, we are their best friend, their supporter, their enabler, and on the other hand, we pretend to be this impartial, aid in negotiations. And the Palestinians understand quite well that this is not an impartial role the U.S. is playing. And this has meant that these negotiations have always been failures. And I think will continue to be failures if the U.S. attempts again to play that role. I think that the one thing that the U.S. can do that will make a real difference is not to do something new, but to stop doing what we have been doing, to not give all of that money, to not block criticism of Israel in the UN and international bodies. The fact that we're giving Israel so much aid gives us enormous power to use pressure to change Israeli policies, and we don't use that at all. We don't use that at all. And we just continue to fund this really ongoing catastrophe as it just spins further and further out of control.
In spite of it all, you have some small sense of optimism.
I do, yeah. And I do because, not because things are getting better in Israel, because they're not. They're getting more and more right-wing and more openly racist and violent. Not because I have things are getting better on the Palestinian side either, but I think things are changing here. And I think that the fact that we're having this conversation now is a sign of that. I think for there have been gradual shifts over the last decade or so of more and more openness in the American media. It's become more and more possible to offer criticisms of Israel, which was really excluded from the U.S. media for years. And I think a lot of Americans, especially younger Americans, are ready for and hungry for a real conversation about this. And it's a conversation that we haven't been having, or we've been having one side of it, and kind of closing down all criticism of Israel. But I don't think that's possible anymore. I think what we're seeing what we're going to be seeing at the Democratic Convention with Sanders appointees to the platform drafting committee insisting on mentioning Palestinian rights, insisting on using the word occupation, insisting on having a more inclusive policy platform on Israel and Palestine. This is an enormous change. It was kind of unthinkable that in any of the previous presidential elections we would be using the word Palestinian, we'd be using the word occupation, we'd be talking about, you know, the legitimate, you know, rights of Palestinians, because this conversation has been limited to talking about the security needs of Israel.
Of course, part of that is the fact that the Israeli government has so overplayed its hand.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, there's nothing to stop them from doing so. Netanyahu's, you know, conflicts with Barack Obama have been, you know, reported on quite a bit in the U.S. and international press, and which has been sort of strange to watch because, you know, Netanyahu will do something fairly offensive to Obama. There'll be a quick little rift and they'll kind of move on. But what's been really clear throughout is no matter how much sort of personal dislike there may be between those men, is Obama doesn't change American policy, that he still blocks all criticism at the UN. You know, Obama's administration has been involved for the last few months with negotiations with Israel over the aid package, in which Netanyahu has been holding out and demanding more money. By most reports, he wants at least $5 billion in aid a year, and Obama has been trying to keep it to $4 billion. So whatever sort of superficial conflicts there may be between the U.S. and between a U.S. administration and Israel, the money keeps going forth, the military relationship keeps going forth, and the kind of absolute backing of all of their policies remains unchanged. And that, I think, is something that will have to change if the situation is going to change at all. Because the Israeli, you know, government and government after government in Israel correctly understands that there will be no consequences for anything that they do. That they will, regardless of how much they overstep and regardless of how horrified the rest of the world is by their actions, the U.S. government will support them absolutely. And that has to change.
Ben Ehrenreich. Ben, I thank you so much for spending time with us here on Radio Who, What, Why.
Thank you, Jeff. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.